A communications disruption can mean only one thing: invasion.
A communication disruption can only mean one thing:
negotiation. We've lost all communication.
Invasion. What will the future of Star Wars bring?
You must contact me.
You must contact me and listen to Reed.
They wouldn't dare.
It's unthinkable.
In this sea orbitals, bubble, bubble, Star Wars prequels appreciation podcast.
It's outrageous.
Hello, and welcome back to CO Bibbles Babble Bubble, your tongue twister one-stop shop for all things that is prequels appreciation. Not prequels apologist, mind you, as I've stated many times on Twitter and on the show and in person. I do not like that phrase, prequels apologist. I'm not apologizing for anything. I appreciate stuff. And this week, we have a very special guest who also is a prequel appreciator and an appreciator of all things Star Wars. It's a real pleasure to have Mr. Alden Diaz of Octo Radio himself here on the show.
I'm ready to do some appreciating tonight, my friend.
All right.
I love the intro. I love the philosophy. I love everything that stands for. I don't think I've apologized for these in about 10 years, and I never will again.
Oh, no. I think that one thing that the sequels gave us, and by us I mean more than you and me, but just the fandom in general, was it removed the idea that you had to apologize for liking the prequels, mm-hmm. which was, you know, I retroactively shamed myself for being that guy in college, in high school, like trying to tell other people, like, no, trust me, it's good, I'm sorry, you know, you don't like it, but no, it's statements
Absolutely.
Of fact, it's fun. If you don't like it, that's okay, but I do. You know, there's no need to backtrack.
Definitely. The Renaissance has been just so refreshing, and, you know, shout out to the memers of the internet and just everybody that put so much effort into keeping the ongoing jokes going, and the comedy has invigorated it, and people coming back into the family, like Ahmed Best and you know, and Hayden. Like, it's just a good time.
Mm-hmm. And I guess semi-recently, old Liam Neeson, you know, coming out and waving his prequel flag proudly.
Oh yeah. So, you know, talking about how it was a great experience, and his point of view is correct. You know, like, he got to have a lightsaber, he got to be a great character. Like, he I think is ready. I think he's like, you know, make me a Force ghost. I hear Ewan's about to do something, but yeah. I think that I mean, they all have a really good perspective. Even Natalie Portman on Saturday Night Live with the say something about the mother effing prequels.
Yeah, it's great. You love to see it, and that it's continuing to be resurgent and whatnot. So before we dive into the conversation topic of this week, I wanted to just apologize to you, Alden, because last week I did the musical improv in haikus on various Star Wars characters, and we ran out of time before all of the characters you suggested got to have a song or a haiku about them. And so there was one who missed the cut, and that was Tech, the clone. So I felt like Tech deserved... I can't do the musical improv because I don't have guitars. That was my other guest who could do all that. But I'll do the haiku for Tech.
I'm ready. I'm so ready.
That there clone is Tech. Bad batch homeboy through and through. I like his goggles.
That was beautiful. That really was just a... it really was a summation of his entire ethos. Uh-huh. I relived some of his greatest moments in my mind. It was a whole journey. Time slowed down.
You know, fun fact, you know, Disney was not sure whether or not to make that Bad Batch show. So they're like, oh, you know, we need some inspirations. They called me up. I just read them that haiku beforehand. And they're like, yes. Yeah. So I've been sitting on this for a while now because it basically made the show happen.
It's like a boardroom scene. And you got like Kathy's there, Filoni, Carrie mm-hmm. Beck. And they've got, you know, just like one of those corporate boardroom, like, catch all speakers in the center, and they're like, you got to call the babble, the babble bubble.
I'll call the babble bubble.
They hit a
See
button.
What they have to say. it was hard though, because for some reason Jon Favreau was in the room too, and I could hardly get a word in over his Jungle Book font.
He's like, you know, so we could render the Bad Batch in game engine.
Oh, there we go. But anyhow, into the exciting stuff. So this week we're going to dive into one of my favorite movies. No surprise, because there's only three of them you can really pick from in this show. But we're going with Attack of the Clones. And not just any aspect of Attack of the Clones, but just the zany, wonderful, amazing goofballs and some heroes, too, who we see hanging out in the background of the film. Or maybe they get some lines in, they get to have their moment, but they only show up in Attack of the Clones. And that's it.
Attack of the Clones people are some of the greatest, some Hall of Fame background people here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a non-scientific fact, but I think Attack of the Clones has the most random background characters consistently throughout the whole film. I mean, if you're excluding like stormtroopers or whatnot, you know, I mean, because you have, like, you look at some other movies where, okay, well, look at all the random rebels here, or here they are, you know, everybody in the casino or everybody in this cantina. But I feel like in Attack of the Clones, and like I said, I could be totally wrong about this, you get just like smack damn one person after the next. Like, oh, here's everybody at the diner. Here's everybody at the arena. Everybody at the club. Everybody in the Senate. It's just an overwhelming amount of people and aliens. The movie never gets old because I feel like you see something new each and every time.
That's absolutely true. I mean, there's so many almost like, I don't even know what to describe them, but like these shared experiences with other people in the fandom where as you get older and as you've grown up with the prequel films, you start to hear other fans say, oh yeah, and you know, in the club scene when they're chasing down Zam Wessel, I love this character. And you're like, wait, who? Who are you talking about? And then they unlock a whole new corner. Or suddenly you're like, I got to rewatch this right now. And then you're like, oh my God, yeah, it is. That is Ahmed Best. Or, oh wow, she is. You know, like it's an endless gift that keeps on giving.
It absolutely is. So I think there's not a better place to start this discussion than let's just go with the Zam Wessel chase, where we get to see Coruscant in a way that no other film has ever shown us. Where you get to go see the Coruscant knife life. You actually get to see the ground. Now, it turns out it's not the ground, but we think it's the ground at first before you realize it gets a whole lot lower. But at least Anakin rolls on what appears to be a ground, not some platform floating in the sky very obviously.
Right.
And they get to go to the, I don't know, is it a club? Is it a sports bar? Is it something in between? I mean, they have multiple sports going on
Outlander Club.
The Outlander Club. So we're kicking it with a club. So fun fact about, you know, we're talking about characters who show up just in this movie, but I do want to give a shout out to a favorite of yours. I don't know if you knew this, you probably would, but how Dud Bolt, the pod racer, makes an appearance in that bar scene because it's his pod racer on the TV.
Dud Bolt, listen, they were probably watching the Dud Bolt, like, the ESPN like 30 for 30 on Dud Bolt, like a documentary feature that they all gathered in the bar. They were like, oh, they're playing the Dud Bolt special, you know, like obviously, you know, we're recording this in the year of our Lord 2020. And one of the only things people have been really excited about is that Michael Jordan doc. That's what that was for Dud Bolt.
It's like, oh my God, finale part eight. Bolt.
Exactly.
No, I'm a big Dud Bolt fan, and so, you know, of course, I don't know which viewing of that scene it took for me to realize which pod racer that was, you know, because it takes a while at first. You're so overwhelmed, and, you know, you're a kid, and then young adulthood, but you're like, oh, that one looks super familiar, and then to cross-reference what you knew is, oh my God, it's Dud Bolt, the guy with the crocodile face and the cool goggles and the thing hanging off his nose, and yeah, everything's great, and it confirms that he's a superstar, you know. And so that alone is just exciting enough because you'd expect, oh, Sebulba is going to be on there because he always wins, or Gaz Gano because he got second place. No, old Dud Bolt. Salute that.
Absolutely.
But you know, I digress. We're going to original background people, or, you know, single shot people. So Alden, is there anybody in that club, in that bar, who sticks out to you? Is like, this is just a great person who encapsulates all the magic that Attack of the Clones brings?
Yeah, there actually is. I want to highlight somebody named Hadi Gofi, or Hadi Gofi, however you want to say her name. And she stuck out to me, like, literally on my first viewing. This is the first Star Wars film I saw in theaters. I was 6 years old. It was a great time. It was a religious experience. And even then, I was like, that's a little, you know, I don't know. It's a little spicy. It's a little spicy for a Star Wars movie. I didn't even know how to phrase it, because you don't really know how to contextualize words like sensual. But she is the background character with sort of like a pinup, almost like rockabilly looking hairstyle, who gives Anakin like the eyes, like she sizes him up.
Yeah.
Like a piece of Jedi action just rolled in. And Anakin, you know, he's looking around and he's like, Jedi, this is Jedi business. Like, he's never felt cooler in his life. But Hattie Go-Fi is like, what's up, man? How's it going? You want to meet me outside? Leave the Death Stick guy in here with your buddy and we can go spar around. Like, it's pretty intense.
Oh, no. Yeah. Great. Like, heavy eye makeup, heavy lips. You know, it's a cool look that, like you say, it's a combination of sort of different trends in fashion. Like you say, a little bit rockabilly, you got a little bit of that kind of like 80s punk going on there. And then plus like the perception of what sci-fi clothing is supposed to look like. So, you know, and what that tells about in this whole scene in general is Star Wars up to that point, at least when you look at the original trilogy, didn't really lend itself to all of the usual, and I don't mean trappings in a negative way here, but I'll say it, trappings of sci-fi expectations of, oh, this is what the future will look like. This is how people in the future will dress.
Right.
This is how, you know, because it's like people living in the desert, you know, on Tatooine, and the rebels are all just kind of wearing goofy looking military outfits. It wasn't like Star Trek or when we see later Blade Runner, you know, that's trying to, let's piece together what the future looks like, because, you know, as we all know, it technically doesn't take place in the future.
They right.
Make it very clear. But I feel like, you know, in that club scene in particular, that's when you start to see some of the, like, usual creative expectations of what a sci-fi outfit is supposed to look like and how a sci-fi person will present themselves. You know, it feels very much like it's dipping into that inspiration, kind of like a sexy Jetsons character.
Wow, you completely nailed it. I mean, that is the aesthetic. I mean, sexy Jetsons, first of all, that's going to be our spinoff podcast.
Sexy Jetsons.
Just talking about Coruscant scenes. Welcome to the Sexy Jetsons. No, but
it's a great band name, too.
Isn't it, though? Yeah, like that's like an in-universe band name. But the interesting thing that you touched on there is how Star Wars has never tried to approximate or predict or give an estimation of any type of future aesthetic. It's always been a blend of its influences that it wears on its sleeve. So when you see something like this, you're wondering, you know, maybe what was George pulling from, or what did he tell the design team to try to convey? And, you know, you've got your obvious things like how there's all the Western allusions, more so in the original trilogy. So this is sort of like George saying, give me a little bit of that American Graffiti that I like, you know, maybe with like her rockabilly hair, but also maybe this is George saying, you know, I haven't actually injected as much sci-fi as maybe I originally wanted to. It's like a little bit of the THX George maybe bubbling to the surface.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's super cool. And it's every single shot in that club, you get to see a little dip into that I think is just a nice nod to stereotypical sci-fi.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so I think that's super cool. One, I'm going to point to the visual dictionary here, which, as I said, but told you before the show, and some other people may have heard this as I was preparing for this episode and complaining to friends about it. I thought I had this visual dictionary because I read it all the time. And, you know, I was looking through my books here. I called my parents like, oh, God, do we got to go to the storage unit, you know, trying to figure about it. And then eventually I spoke with a friend from my childhood who's like, oh, yeah, we went to the library and looked at that one a lot. Like, oh, my God, I just, like, wasted 2 hours running around trying to find this book I didn't have.
That's deeply depressing, Reed. Depressing.
It's very sad. But one thing that's nice is if you Google images, Star Wars Attack of the Clones visual dictionary, there are a lot of screen grab. It's not a screen grab because it's from a book, but a lot of pictures and scans from that book in Google images. And so you can sort of piece together little pieces of the book. So they have one probably eighth of a page about the club scene, which I'll read out now. Con artists merge into the crowd at the nightclub, Tonight's miscreants include a professional kidnapper, a crime lord's enforcer, and the unconvincing, in quotations, Lieutenant Fatone, dressed in a stolen military uniform.
Fatone.
Lieutenant Fatone. And I'm looking at his picture right now. I don't really remember him, though I'm sure I'll notice it next time I watch through. And I think it's interesting that he is wearing a military uniform, because it may be outside of, you know, the Naboo, like, Royal Guard.
Mm-hmm.
The first, like, military uniform that we see in the prequels.
I think you're correct, because, you know, even the separatists were sort of in the early stages. The Trade Federation, even the higher command, like the, you know, your Nuke Gunrays, like, they're more wearing formal garb. Like, they haven't unveiled any sort of hierarchy. And even when they do get generals, it's guys like Grievous.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Or you get, yeah, just droid commanders, like, you just paint them up differently.
Right.
When it comes to it. But we see this guy, the so-called Lieutenant Fatone, he's got chevrons on his sleeve. So I think that's a nice little background that, you know, George or the costume designer, or both of them are an AD, wanted to say, well, we need to have the existence of a military establishment somewhere, which just raises the question, what type of military officer is he trying to replicate being? Because as we know, there is no, at least at the beginning of the film, Grand Army of the Republic. But obviously there's some non-clones in the military, and we know that, you know, Tarkin has a military background and whatnot. So I don't know who's he's trying to replicate here, but I think that's a fun little tidbit that hidden underneath our nose the whole time was a military uniform.
Absolutely. I think that is really cool. And, you know, obviously he did not show up to the Outlander Club alone. Someone else who has the similar outfit is his partner, his close associate, I believe, as StarWars.com describes him, and that's Ahmed Beck.
Aha, and there we go. And that's Ahmed Best's character.
Yeah, so you've got, these are the first, I think they're, up until Jedi Temple Challenge, both of these men, Anthony Daniels and Ahmed Best's first live action and only live action Star Wars appearances. And it's really cool to see them, and they add so much flavor. And again, it sort of lends itself to that behind the scenes legend type feel. Star Wars fans constantly finding out these new details. But the two of them, you know, conning somebody, maybe trying to infiltrate a military installation. Maybe this is a place where, you know, this whatever military force this is, you know, they hang out like on shore leave, and these guys are trying to infiltrate a cruiser. Like, there could be a whole comic miniseries about this job.
Oh, yeah. Or I like this one. They just made up their own uniforms themselves. Because they're like, there's no standing Galactic Army of the Grand Army of the Republic, pardon me. We're just going to make our own uniforms and pretend to be military men from some planet nobody's ever been to, like Jakku.
No one goes back to Jakku. They'll never Nobody be able goes, to check.
They'll never be able to check. So there they are. They're the Jakku Royal Guard. Like, oh, Jakku. Yeah, I've heard there's some cool stuff. Oh, yeah, yeah, we keep it safe. And then maybe it's kind of like a Nigerian prince situation. Like, oh, well, you know, the king of Jakku, you know, he's got a bank account he needs to get into right now, but he just needs to put a little bit of money in to get some out. So if you just give us like 10,000 credits, you're going to get a million next week.
Like, I love it.
These guys are men in uniform. So
this is the story that I want to be canon.
I also love that the visual dictionary references a miscreant who is a professional kidnapper.
It's a little dark for Star Wars.
Yeah, you know, it's not like, oh, it's a bounty hunter who happens to kidnap on the side, or it's an amateur kidnapper. No, this person, like, lives to kidnap. And I don't
He's
know.
Like, I will decline other work. I only kidnap.
It's something else. And so when they have this write-up, there's there's three people lined up. There's from right to left, it's Fatone referencing the unconvincing lieutenant. There's a crime lord's enforcer, and we see a picture of a human with that kind of, once again, sexy Jetson look, because it was more spiky hair and a cool faux cloak. And then it's labeled as a mask weequay with hidden knockout drops. So I think that's who our professional kidnapper is, which I love the idea that there's a weequay running around kidnapping people.
I like that too, but I sort of, and I know that obviously the term, we know, you're listening right now, you're like, well, guys, you know, kidnapping doesn't necessarily just refer to children, but I am saying It is horrifying to think about a Weequay sneaking up on like a 6-year-old kid and hitting them with a knockout drop. That is horrifying, George. Out of control.
Yeah, yeah. Normally it'd be like, when I say normally, we're going to normalize kidnapping here. It'd be like, oh, it's not a masked Weequay. It's a human with a mustache. Instead of hitting knockout drops, he's got lollipops in an unmarked van. But no, this Weequay means business. Like, they know the kids, like, can put up a fight.
He's like, I'm not here to seduce your child. He's like, I'm knocking them out from the get. We're going. We don't have time to spare.
We got a long ride back to the kingdom of Jakku, so we got to make sure he's sleeping.
We got credits to spend, baby.
Woo! It's like, you know, there's those, like in James Bond or any sort of spy movie where they have the, like, somebody hits the table and that secret drawer unslides and, wow, look at all these weapons you can choose from. Like, oh, here's a pen that blows up your car. Here's a baseball bat that has a gun in it. You know, I like imagining there's one for kidnappers. And the Weequay had a choice between, like, oh, well, here's lollipops or here's chloroform. Like, knockout drops. Yeah. Like, I'll go with that one. That's my signature.
It's phenomenal.
It's the Kidnappers Guild. They were not invited to join the Confederacy of Independent Systems, I'm afraid. But, you know, who knows? Maybe they're doing okay. I wonder if Palpatine, you know, centralized the Kidnappers Guild into the state.
Well, I mean, honestly, by the time of, you know, the Imperial Remnant with characters like Moff Gideon, I'm sure they're wishing that they had a Kidnappers Guild. They're like, I'm sending a bunch of regular stooges to try to capture this baby. I could have had some knockout drops.
Get those knockout drops. Yeah. Yeah, kitty, kitty. Oh, my goodness. So I think, well, we're in the club still. It's going to take a long time to get out of the club, you know, just like real life. This is a poppin' club. I think, you know, it's not a discussion about that club until we, without touching on Death Sticks.
Oh, yeah. A fan favorite.
A real fan favorite. I like to think it's not quite at the same level as Viggo Mortensen breaking his foot while kicking the helmet. But people saying, like, yo, you see the guy selling Death Sticks? He was in the Matrix.
It's so
in
good.
In terms of the trivia draw, what is it, Matt Duran?
Yeah, I believe so. He was, Elon Slezbogano.
What a great name right there. And one thing that made me so happy in the whatchamacallit, Alphabet Squadron novels is the fact that they brought his species back, the Balosar. I don't know. I, you know, don't listen to audiobooks of anything, so I don't know where the emphasis is. Balo. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But having those little goofy antennas, being a mere human species. One of my favorite Star Wars Celebration moments was at Celebration 2017 in Orlando. I went to the 501st Bash because Weird Al was playing, which already, like, that's a great statement.
It's like, what a sentence.
What a sentence. Like, that's it. Okay, show's over. Can't beat that. No, there was a guy who was cosplaying as a Slezbogano, and he had little flavored honey sticks. You know, those, like, the size of a candy cane.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he was like, do you want to buy some Death Sticks? And he was selling these for $1 each. And so that's phenomenal. Was like, he had them stuffed in his jacket, like, hey, you want to buy some Death Sticks? And he'd slowly open the jacket and have the honey that was, like, duct taped in. It was a great costume, too. And he had the accent down. He had, like, the shady character, eye darting and everything. It was a cool moment. It's the closest I ever felt like I was in the actual movies.
He really tapped into everybody's inner drug junkie, really brought it out in you. And I think that there's something about, you know, good old Slezbogano is that he sort of was a lot of our introduction to that type of illicit dealer character. Like, yeah. they managed to present it in a PG way, of course, but in the same way that this club scene, you know, introduced me to, like, some really obvious, like, you know, sexuality, it was also like Obi-Wan Kenobi, like, might as well have turned straight into the camera and said, don't do drugs, kids, and make better choices than this man.
This is definitely like the John Cena moment. You know, like, do your homework, kids.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Obi-Wan's like, you know, say your prayers, eat your vitamins with his mullet. It's phenomenal. Obi-Wan is Hulk Hogan in this scene.
He is the most baby face of baby faces.
Yes, precisely.
And it was obvious Anakin was turning heel from the get-go. But you know what? The writers decided to milk that out, even though we saw it coming a mile away. Should have just sped it all up. But no, yes. Great scene. Great characters. Do you have anybody else from the club you want to bring up?
I did not. I mean, outside of, you know, maybe Zam herself, but I think that we are good in the club. I just wanted to make one note on Sileese Begana before we left. I think outside of maybe Savage Opress, that is the most, like, make a villain name, like, out of all Star Wars names.
Sileese Begana, yeah.
George is like, can you make me a name that's sleazy, like a sleaze bag? And then someone's like, I got you, say less. Pablo's like, George, George,
it's going to be okay. Oh, I love it. But yeah, this is a good pivot to Zam Wessel herself. The real epitome, like if you had to pick who summarizes single character Attack of the Clones, it's between her and someone else we'll get to later. But I think Zam Wessel really sums it up well. Cool looking character, drives a dope speeder that has the greatest noise in all of Star Wars.
It's great.
And awesome outfit. And gets killed like a quarter of the way into the first act. You know, she feels so important to the movie while you're watching it. And it's just a total like, nope, no, this is not going anywhere.
Yeah, it's sad. You know, I know they had obviously their allusion to A New Hope with Obi-Wan doing the, you know, reverse flip, take your arm off, little spin there. But it was sad to lose her. I mean, I think that she was female villains. Or female coded villains, you know, obviously this is a changeling. It could be, you know, the Claudites. It could be a little ambiguous. I'd have to do a little bit of research. But, you know, female villains across Star Wars are you know, fewer in number. And it was nice to see that even as a kid, she had significance seeing that Jango treated her like an equal. So it was sad to lose her. But like you're saying, she gave us so much. I mean, the Claudite species, the concept of changelings in Star Wars, like it's the kind of thing that when you're a kid, you're like, of course they're shapeshifters. Like, of course, like this is such a magical world. Like that was so cool. It's fantasy, it's sci-fi, you know, that rogue archetype of, you know, where is she in the bar? Like it added an element of, oh, she could take on Jedi because the Jedi, you know, in their anxiety of wanting to catch her, they're having to take things slow. Obi-Wan's like, I'm going for a drink. Like you could tell this could go south for them. And so she makes a huge impact. And I think that, you know, stuff you touched on, like with the ship and the sound, just a really, really effective use of screen time.
Mm-hmm. My unpopular Star Wars opinion that probably stirs up the most heat is that the speeder chase scene in Attack of the Clones is better than half of the Falcon runs.
You know, honestly, I could be with you there. And you know, maybe Han and Chewie are doing, and you know, and Lando and L3, Rey, everyone that steps into the Falcon cockpit, maybe they are doing cooler things, but this one has elements that those don't have.
Like, oh, yeah.
A Jedi falling through a city, you know, and landing on the enemy craft and his lightsaber stabbing through the roof while she flies. Like, very creative in terms of designing an action set piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not an apples to oranges thing. I mean, it's not apples to apples. It is apples to oranges, but they're both fruit. And that scene always makes me super happy. You know, I feel like when Anakin is laughing during that scene, you know, as they're going through the electrical field and just reacting to it and laughing at Obi-Wan's just kind of being like, Anakin, why are we doing this? I hate it when you fly. All that jazz.
Yeah.
I feel like Anakin there, you know, just, it's just a pure delight and excitement. And, you know, it's one of my favorite scenes in Star Wars, straight up. And I can see that objectively, there's probably stuff better than it, but it's just so cool that you see so much.
It's joyous. And other aspects of it, you know, you mentioned that sound and that speeder, but even like down to the very small details, like something that has stuck with me, obviously, I'll give a shout out to her first weapon before I get to the second weapon. The KYD-21 blaster pistol is really cool that she, you know, tries to use on Obi-Wan in the club. but it's the Kai Steer 1284 projectile rifle, her sniper.
Oh my gosh.
Because that red scope, while Obi-Wan is hanging on to her assassin drone that dropped off the millipede things, that image of like, oh man, like she's training, you know, she's going to get the shot and everything. And then she does. Like, she could have probably given him a headshot if this was a little bit of a darker movie. But yeah, I mean, she really gives our heroes a run for their money. So I totally get why you love the scene. Who didn't want to be Anakin, you know, jumping all, you know, that whole distance and flying down and, you know, who didn't want to annoy, you know, their master that way? I hate it when he does that. Like, I want it to be him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's when it really clicks that I like Hayden as Anakin. You know, that's what it takes to be like, we're seeing him for the first time. You're like, okay, they naturally had to age the character up because time passed and Jake Lloyd isn't there. And you're feeling, oh, how is this guy who most people didn't know?
Right.
As is so often the case with Star Wars. And of course, as a kid seeing it for the first time, I had no idea who he was. But just clicking like, oh, you know, he is touching on this so well. I really resonate with this character and how he's being portrayed. And that scene is incredibly important.
Yeah. And him, Anakin, and Zam is the first showdown that we really get with the Anakin Skywalker that we've heard so much about. You know, your father was a cunning warrior. Like, this is a Star Wars fight. Like, you know, it's not a lightsaber duel, but it is a one-on-one fight in the air.
Which, that alone, great sentence right there too. A fight in the air. You can't top that. So let's fast forward a little bit in the movie where the real element of the detective story goes in full blast as we go to the greatest eating establishment in the entirety of Star Wars, Dex's Diner. Old Dex Jetster.
Oh, the best.
If Sam Wessel was the number two quintessential Attack of the Clones character, Dex Jetster is clearly number one. And, you know, there's so much to say about him, and I've talked about him a lot on this show. I feel like everybody's talked about him at some point because he's just that lovable. But Alden, I want to hear your takes on, you know, give me your best Dex takes. Even, you know, go with the Dex Jetster impersonation while you're at it, too.
Well, you know, you gotta be like, Reed, what do you know about Dex? Reed on the Babble Bubble.
He's the greatest. I mean, he's one of the greatest friends in all of Star Wars. Exceedingly loyal. You know, literally stops working at his establishment. That's income that he's leaving on the table. To stop and go and sit in the booth with his buddy. And he just injects so much flavor into this movie. Because what do we know about Star Wars up to that point? In the fabric of Star Wars is this idea that there are stories before the story. That in Medus Res Feel, Obi-Wan, you know, Alec Guinness's Obi gives so much with so little. Where you're like, wow, the Clone Wars. Whoa, Anakin, a cunning warrior. And you start thinking about, what have I not seen? This scene is filled with those implications. Like, have these two been on cases together before? Like, is Dex an informant? Like, is Dex one of those guys that's like, I retired from the game and now I run this diner, but I was secretly a badass. Like, there's so much here. Like, the fact that he was doing like prospecting work and the fact that he knows cloners and all of this stuff. Like, there's so much bubbling beneath the surface of what is a comedic character. And you get the great Besselisk design, obviously, which especially captures a kid. You know, we see it later with Grievous, but we're kids. We're suckers for things with multiple arms. It's just cool. And with Rio Durant later on as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, for me, it was just this idea of, what does this guy know? And also the fact that you had never seen, you know, if a Jedi in that almost, I guess it's not a one-to-one, but in a Batman Commissioner Gordon type way. And he even has a mustache, you know, like, I'm going to go to somebody and get a little bit of info, put my ear to the ground, get to the heart of the city. And it's like, if the entire planet is a city and this guy knows, as a kid, that just sends your mind racing.
Oh, absolutely. One thing about that conversation, and I love the implications of it, is when he talks about the Kaminoans as cloners and damn good ones too, who are the bad ones? And how common is like the art of cloning?
Yeah.
You know? I mean, enough to be generally aware of that. And that's something that I feel like, I mean, maybe in some comics, because I'm not that much of a comic reader, either now with the current stuff or even, you know, back then with like the old Legends stuff or whatnot. But I feel like I'd love to know more about just the cloning process. And are there other species and planets as dedicated to cloning, or is it more like business establishments?
Yeah. And
that cloning going on.
I mean, and even when we get to Kamino, there's, you know, in the conversations with, you know, other Attack of the Clones characters that we'll touch on, but with, you know, Lamassu, and the implication of like, yeah, this was our most ambitious job, but you know, we've done a little something on the side before. We've made smaller batches for other people. Like, who out there are clones? Is it possible that there is a species in Star Wars that we know that originally was a rarity and is only prevalent because of cloning? Like, that would be an interesting story.
I like that a lot. That's fascinating. Yeah, with the Kamino and things, when he said we've done smaller orders and this is the most ambitious one, I mean, getting the clone army is massive. So that's a huge ceiling you can go down below. When they say, you know, smaller projects, how much smaller are we talking? Even if it's half, a quarter, a fifth, a tenth, that's still huge. Absolutely. You know, that's not just like a handful of people. That's, you know, a couple hundred or thousands, considering how many people they did, and even just that first load there. But we get ahead of ourselves with the Kamino ones, as we acknowledge. We're going to stick in the diner, where I feel like what really ties together the diner is the unspoken but very clear tension and dynamic between the two ladies who help operate the place. And we're talking about Hermione Bagua and WA7.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I think Hermione, who's the, believe it or not, the second most famous Hermione of the era.
Believe it or not.
Believe it or not. You'd think she'd be number one.
Super no, close there was this, race, honestly.
This little, yeah, very close. This little British girl was running around somewhere. No, the... her aesthetic absolutely touches on, you know, what you were saying earlier about how going with that 50s vibe, the whole diner touches on that. That even in the visual dictionary, this is another little visual dictionary clip here, it describes that little blue dress she's wearing as dress style harks back to earlier time. So it's even like very on your nose evident that we are trying to replicate that American graffiti feel,
right?
That, you know, mid-century American aesthetic. And
love it.
I think it's funny, the visual dictionary also talks about how Dexter's waitress, Hermione Bagua, duels with WA7 for mastery of the dining room. Each is convinced that she has the superior position. Hermione grew up in the Coruscant underlevels and feels very fortunate to work on the surface now.
Hmm.
Nice little tease there, and about what else is there under Coruscant. And I remember when I read this book back when I was, I guess, let's see, when the movie came out, I was 8. Yeah, so the whole 8, 9, 10 range. I wanted to see so much more of Coruscant. And this was a little tease because, you know, the diner looks to be in a maybe not reputable area of town, but clean. Definitely cleaner than where the bar was.
Absolutely.
And so it definitely, you know, raises the question that in just the first 30 minutes, we've seen Coruscant in two completely different new ways. What's in between, what's above, what's below, all that.
And, yeah, it's true. And if you add in, window, you know, you factor in like Padme's apartment, then you really are seeing this wide selection of locations.
Absolutely. Now, would you say you're team Hermione or your team WA7?
You know, I'm going to go WA7, and I'll tell you why. It's Obi-Wan's fault, because this scene was the first time as a child where I was like, oh, Obi-Wan's not perfect. Like, and now I go back to like Phantom Menace and I can see some of his flaws as well. You know, mm-hmm. as a younger man, you know, more brash, a little arrogant, a little dismissive of people like Jar Jar, you know, useless life form and things like that. But when you see Obi-Wan in this scene say, well, you know, if droids could think and, you know, there would be no reason. You know, immediately I'm like, huh? Like, Obi-Wan, like, it's a little shady. It's a little, you know, negative, a little negative way to, like, L3 would have words for this man. so he makes me want to support droid rights and droids' place in the diner. And I think that, you know, no disrespect to Hermione, but I think that Hermione should try to, you know, utilize maybe what she can learn from our mechanical friends.
Well, you know, I think what you see happening in the diner is a very classic example of upper management of the bourgeoisie you know, making different elements of the working class despise one another.
So it's Dex's fault.
It's all Dex's. Yeah, because he's basically a capitalist with a top hat and a monocle over there, you know. But it's the workers of the workers of the diner unite, I say.
I agree. Is there going to be like a Coruscant dining union?
I mean, Dex will do everything in his power to stop it from happening. He'll call in Maz to, you know, settle that union dispute.
Start settling you. She flies in on a jetpack, knocks over a cup of Java juice. No!
That's actually where she was. We know when they call her in The Last Jedi. We're not 100% certain.
It finally boiled over.
It finally boiled over, you know. At this point, we're on, like, Hermione Bagua's granddaughter. You know, if she's her... Hermie 1 Bagua. This is Hermie 3 Bagua, you know, three generations down. Hermie 3 Bagua is like, I can't take it anymore. Yeah, her and WA-10 finally got together. And
it's like, for 1,000 generations, the Baguas have served Jawa juice for no insurance.
Hermione's like, yo, hey, Dex, can I go see my dad? He's in the hospital. Because that's how she talks for some reason. I talk like this. Can I see my dad? He's in the hospital. And Dex is all, ah, no. Because it's the rush hour. Otherwise, he's also turning to be like someone from Brooklyn. Hey, I'm Dex. Welcome to the diner.
What kind of doofus request is that? You come to me in the middle. In the middle of rush hour, while we're trying to hawk the lunch specials, and you tell me your dad is in the hospital? What's wrong with you?
You see that guy at that table right there? That there is Masa Mater. Your dad isn't worth 1/52nd of that dude's left leku. Now go serve him a platter.
Masa Mater is that guy that sends food back 100%.
Oh, no, absolutely. He is the most Karen of Karens.
Oh, I love it so much. What a scene.
What a scene. I tell you, labor disputes in the works.
Well, what do you know?
What's up, Outlanders and Inlanders? Seal Bibbles, Babble Bubble, the Sexy Jetsons. It's gonna resume next week for a part 2. So for the time being, just keep it groovy and keep it jamming.